And I had the judge here saying that he gonna make sure, he made me a promise and commitment, he's gonna make sure that I have a fair and impartial jury trial. And unbeknown to me, you know, later, a year later when I went to trial, he was the very same person that destroyed my hopes of having a fair trial and just
In the last two episodes of the Section G podcast, we looked back at Judge Frank Shea's political career, his judicial style, the way he kept certain lawyers out of his courtroom, and above all else, his desire for speed. In this episode, we're going to look at what it was like to be a defendant in front of Frank Shea, specifically, what it was like to be a defendant charged with murder, and the particular ways in which Shea's judicial style could influence a trial where someone's life was on the line. Isaac Knapper and George Toka have similar stories. They were both teenagers when they were accused of killings in New Orleans they claimed to have nothing to do with. They were both tried in front of Judge Frank Shea. They were both convicted, and they were both eventually let out of prison when serious questions were raised about their guilt. Combined, they spent nearly 50 years in prison. Toka's trial lasted a day and a half, and Knapper's, it was over in a day. I'm Nick Crestle with The Lens, and this is the Section G podcast. The audio you just heard from inside Judge Shea's courtroom, that's from George Toka's trial back in 1985. Toka was 17 when he was arrested for the murder of his best friend, Eric Batiste. Prosecutors said that Toka and Batiste were engaged in a robbery following a school dance when Toka accidentally shot Batiste. Toka has always said that he was at a motel with his girlfriend at the time. He was charged with first-degree murder, and he was set to be tried in Section G of New Orleans Criminal District Court in front of Judge Frank Shea. The first time Toka appeared in front of Shea, following his indictment, he was anxious. But he was hopeful that he could show Shea that they had the wrong guy.
I went into the courtroom. I remember it being cold, and you know, it just seemed so, you know, foreign or whatever, and kind of intimidating. But I believe that a judge should, you know, this is a judge that he should be able to help and do his job, and I should be able to show him my innocence.
Shea, in fact, was at least able to provide Toka with some comforting words. He told him that he personally would ensure that Toka had a fair trial.
I had the judge here saying that he's going to make sure, he made me a promise and commitment, he's going to make sure that I have a fair and impartial jury trial.
The promise stuck with Toka. But when he finally went to trial a year later, in 1985, he wasn't prepared for the swiftness with which justice was handled in Section G.
Well, the first day of the trial began, I began to see some real bizarre and bizarre behavior from Judge Frank Shea. How he was rushing the testimony of the witness. He just rushed the whole process. He rushed the whole trial with rushing. Saying he had a 5 o'clock appointment. Let's come on with it. The witness already asked that. Let's move on. Let's keep it going. I mean, his whole conduct and everything he was doing that first day of the trial, trying to rush the trial so he could make an appointment was shocking.
Shea was combative as usual, demanding the lawyers move things along. "You and I have known each other for a long time," he told Toka's lawyer at one point, according to the trial transcript. "Don't run over me when I make a ruling." He was just as impatient with the prosecution. After Shea told her to move on from a line of questioning, the prosecutor offered a mild protest. "We don't argue, Miss Smith," Shea told her. "I don't argue with attorneys. I rule. That's it." I talked to Toka's lawyer, Henry Julian Jr., a few years ago before he died in 2019. Like everyone, he recalled Shea's overriding focus on speed and his desire to clear his docket. And he remembered Toka's case in particular. It didn't take as long as it should have, he recalled. Shea was rushing people in that case. But the real injustice, in Toka's eyes, came after Shea rushed through the trial arguments. On the afternoon of the second day, the jury went off to deliberate. Toka was sitting in the back for 5 or 6 hours. Eventually, according to Toka, a bailiff came and brought him into the court. But no one was in there. Then, after a few minutes, Toka saw Shea emerge from the jury room.
After being back about maybe a couple of hours, the court bailiff called me out the back of the holding pen and brought me out, back out to the courtroom. And when he brought me back out to the courtroom, the courtroom was empty. No one was there. The judge wasn't on the bench. My lawyer, nobody was in the courtroom but me and the bailiff by myself. And so after a few minutes sitting there, I saw the jury room door open up and to my left. And when I looked, there was the judge outside the jury room talking to the jury and, inside the jury room, and the suppressed jury room. He was in there with him.
Toka doesn't know what was said, and the interaction was not recorded in the trial transcript. Toka recalls Shea attempting to treat the situation as innocuous. But Toka says that he thinks that in order to move things along, Shea instructed the jury to compromise on a guilty verdict of second-degree murder.
When Judge Shea went in there, he encouraged them to push them to come with a guilty verdict for second-degree murder. And them not knowing, the consequences of a second-degree murder conviction, which carried mandatory life without parole.
Years later, a lawyer working on Toka's case after he was convicted actually tracked down one of the jurors. She described what happened in an affidavit. "We had some trouble reaching a decision," she wrote. "There was a split and some of us had doubts. I wasn't totally convinced that Toka wasn't at the hotel. The judge came into the jury room to help us with our questions. He was quite a personality. He said that he appreciated us trying to be thorough and taking the time to talk, but could we please try to keep an open mind about coming to an agreement? He was trying to help us reach a consensus." According to the American Bar Association, any communication between the judge and jury should be in the presence of lawyers for each side or with their knowledge. Julian, Toka's lawyer, also recalled the incident, but he also said it was routine practice in Shea's court. If he thought the jury was taking too long, he would saunter into the jury room and ask them what was holding them up, Julian told me. "I don't think it was legal, but he would do it." Toka went on to spend the next 30 years of his life in prison. In 1979, Isaac Napper was a boxer. He was a very good boxer.
I was like 19-0 as an amateur. I was 2-time Golden Glove champion, 1-time Silver Glove champion. And I was training for the Junior Olympics when I was picked up for a crime I didn't commit.
Napper was just 16 years old when he was arrested and accused of killing a man named Ronald Banks, a professor from Maine, in New Orleans to attend a history conference. The attorney Napper's mother wanted to hire for her son's defense was a man named Clyde Merritt. Merritt worked as a public defender and a private defense attorney, and he was known for being combative. Calvin Johnson, who I interviewed in the second episode of this podcast, worked for Clyde Merritt when he was in law school. He described Merritt's style as take no prisoners. To this day, the public defender's office in New Orleans presents a Clyde Merritt Award in honor of Merritt's commitment and fight for the cause of indigent defense. But there was a problem. Napper was set to be tried in Section G, and Merritt and Judge Frank Shea did not get along. In fact, Johnson said that his first memory of Shea was him throwing Merritt out of his courtroom. And by the time Napper's mother approached Merritt about her son's case, it seems that Merritt wasn't even allowed to try cases in Shea's courtroom at all. As Merritt would later put it, it was because he was, quote, too ornery, too aggressive, and made too many objections. But Merritt had an idea. If he could get Robert Ziblich, another defense attorney who was close with Shea, to try the case with him, he might be allowed back in.
That's when my mom hired Clyde Merritt and Robert Ziblich.
Ziblich, it seems, had the opposite reputation among judges and attorneys, which is to say, he was well-liked. In a disciplinary board decision years later, They would note that the evidence was clear that, quote, Mr. Ziblich was an experienced, respected criminal defense attorney who was well-respected by Judge Shea. Another attorney testified that Ziblich was well-liked by prosecutors as well, who trusted him and would regularly share their files with him. That same lawyer said prosecutors tended not to trust Clyde Merritt and would not share their files with him. At the time, Harry Connick led the DA's office. Connick and his prosecutors were known for being aggressive, sometimes to the point of bending or breaking the rules. Convictions under Connick's tenure have faced dozens of successful court challenges. In many cases, because prosecutors failed to disclose evidence that may have favored the defendants, which they're legally required to do. When Napper finally went to trial, the difference in his two lawyer styles came to a head.
But Clyde Merritt didn't agree with the way Robert Ziblich was handling the case, because every time they would say the prosecutor would say something, Robert Ziblich wouldn't object to it, and Clyde Merritt was getting upset. He said, "Now, why won't you object to that?" And Clyde Merritt said, "Oh, something ain't right." So Clyde Merritt knew that Robert Ziblich was working with the prosecutors.
The single-day trial ended in a guilty verdict for first-degree murder. The state's case rested primarily on the word of Napper's alleged co-conspirator, who had been charged himself with first-degree murder, but instead took a manslaughter plea and testified against Napper. When Napper was found guilty, he said that Ziblich, his supposed advocate, didn't say a word to him. Instead, he walked over to the family of the victim and asked if they were satisfied.
When they found me guilty, Robert Ziblich didn't say anything to me or my family. He walked straight over there to the victim's family and hugged them and asked them, was they satisfied? And then he left out the courtroom without saying anything to me or my family. So it was obvious what I never seen him again after that, because he never come see me. Even when they put me in a holding cell, he never come see me to say I'm going to file an appeal. We going to try to get... I never seen him from that day in that courtroom during trial when they found me guilty. I never seen him again.
From Napper's perspective, what happened in his case was part of a broader culture of complicity and racism in Judge Shea's courtroom that bordered on conspiracy.
They look like family. I mean, they play golf together, you know. They live around each other. You know, they just like family, and they stick together. They stick together. They plot. Who's going to be the next victim in that section and who they going to get, you know, and especially if it's a black person. You know, racism is alive and well, and it ain't going to never die. It looks like it's just going to get worse. And that's what they do. That's what they do. They plot on you. They put their schemes together, and they even get with some of the lawyers. If you got the wrong lawyer, and if he's not part of they little thing, some kind of way they'll make a way to mess over him.
Isaac Napper was exonerated in 1991 after the Louisiana Supreme Court found the prosecution in Napper's case failed to turn over a detective's report that contained exculpatory evidence. Toka's case, on the other hand, was set to be heard by the United States Supreme Court in 2015 to decide whether or not a previous ruling that determined sending a juvenile to prison for life without the possibility of parole was unconstitutional should be applied retroactively. That's when the current district attorney, Leon Canizero, offered Toka a plea deal on the condition that he would withdraw his case. Toka took the deal. It got him out of prison, but he had to plead guilty to manslaughter in what's known as an Alford plea. And those who hoped the Supreme Court decision might get them out would have to wait for another year when the Supreme Court took up the issue again. They found that their ruling did apply retroactively. It's possible that even if they had been in front of a different judge, Isaac Napper and George Toka would have still been found guilty. Orleans Parish has the highest rate of exonerations per capita of any major county in the United States, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. Not all of those wrongful convictions came out of Judge Shea's courtroom. But the two cases illustrate defining features of Shea's behavior and the culture of Section G. In Napper's case, his refusal to allow a lawyer to practice in his courtroom without a co-counsel undermined Napper's defense and deflated the adversarial nature of the system as a whole. In Toka's case, Shea rushing the jury interfered with what was meant to be a careful deliberation. In the eyes of both Toka and Napper, it was Shade's desire to save a matter of hours or minutes of time that led to the decades they spent behind bars. I'm Nick Crestel with The Lens, and this is the Section G Podcast.